From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to Washington Watch on this Friday edition. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here, sitting in for Tony Perkins prior to the 4th of July holiday. I'm excited to be with you tonight, and we have lots to talk about, it as we always do on our Friday editions. Last night kicked off the second set of presidential Democratic nominees duking it out, or the candidates rather duking it out in Miami, Florida, and the sparks were definitely flying, more so than Wednesday's debates. And I have some audio clips from some important and critical moments, as well as Terry Jeffrey, who is the editor-in-chief of CNSnews.com, and he'll join me to provide his analysis. In my second segment, I'll address two Supreme Court rulings, one on the U.S. Census and the other on gerrymandering, which is the manipulation of boundaries of an electoral constituency that favor one party over another. Ken Blackwell, FRC Senior Fellow for Human Rights and Constitutional Governance, and conveniently co-chairman of the Census Monitoring Board, will join me. At the bottom of the hour, former Turkish missionary and pastor Andrew Brunson testified yesterday before the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom about the religiously oppressive storm clouds gathering overhead in Turkey. I will talk with Christina Arriaga, one of U.S. SERF's commissioners, who was there at the hearing and will join us with her thoughts. And at 42 past the hour, June 29th is the day of the Christian martyr. Since church tradition teaches that it is the day that marks the martyrdom of the Apostle Paul. I'll talk with Todd Nettleton, the president of the Voice of the Martyrs, as well. Join me at TonyPerkins.com. Follow me on Twitter at Sarah P. Perry. Follow Tony on Twitter at T. Perkins. And as always, we encourage you to find more information about the resources and guests we've mentioned today at TonyPerkins.com and share them with your friends and family. The Associated Press rightly noted that last night's Democratic presidential debate marked an abrupt turning point in a Democratic primary in which the candidates have, for the most part, tiptoed around each other, focusing instead on their shared desire to beat Trump. So with millions of Americans peeking inside the Dems' unruly 2020 season for the first time, the past 48 hours have been interesting. The showdown revealed deep rifts in the party 8 months before primary voting begins, and the Democratic divisions over identity politics, race, age, ideology, sexual orientation, all of these burst fully into plain view. The showdown featured four of the five strongest candidates, according to early polls, at least. Those are Joe Biden, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, Mayor Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, Indiana, and Senator Kamala Harris of California. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who also debated Wednesday night, is the fifth. I've got four of the juiciest sound bites to play for you this segment as we get some insightful analysis from Terry Jeffrey, editor-in-chief of CNSnews.com. Terry, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Terry, I would love to get your input on a comment made by MSNBC's Joe Scarborough this morning. Okay. He is a Republican, or so he claims, who has hated President Trump from the beginning. And speaking of the Democratic presidential candidate last night, he said, so they're lined up in trench warfare, ready to get out the trenches and charge Donald Trump. Instead, they all burn their guns. They all turn their guns on each other, rather, and shoot, and everybody's yelling at each other all night. If you're an American and this is your introduction to these candidates and the Democratic Party, and all you see are 12 people yelling at each other, trying to interrupt, insulting, you're like, you know what? I thought Donald Trump was a clown show. I'm changing the channel. End quote. Terry, was Joe speaking the truth about the Democrats or what?
Yeah, well, you know, I think when you get right down to it, most of the candidates that people saw debating last night and the night before have absolutely no chance of winning the Democratic nomination. And things will be – when things will be absolutely clarified is when they have the Iowa caucus. Only three candidates will emerge from the Iowa caucus as viable candidates. They got a week to go after that to New Hampshire. And Bernie Sanders, because he's from Vermont, must win New Hampshire, or else it would be a huge embarrassment for him. But, if a candidate doesn't finish in the top three in either one or both of those, they're a goner. And so I know for a lot of people looking at it now, you go, my gosh. But the day after Iowa, there'll be a lot of clarity. And most of those people we've seen will be complete non-entities the next day.
Well, and they haven't helped themselves by flooding the field with potential candidates. You know, a lot of these people are people who will have, as Andy Warhol said, fame for 15 minutes and no more. Well, right. Let's go to one of these audio clips, because there was a lot of stuff from those debates that was really it was political gold, as they say. So let's lead with Mayor Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, Indiana. He objected to the fact that many Republicans are also Christians, which in his view is hypocritical. So let's listen to what he said.
The Republican Party likes to cloak itself in the language of religion. Now, our party doesn't talk about that as much, largely for a very good reason, which was we are committed to the separation of church and state, and we stand for people of any religion and people of no religion. But we should call out hypocrisy when we see it. And for a party that associates itself with Christianity, to say that it is okay to suggest that God would smile on the division of families at the hands of federal agents, that God would condone putting children in cages, has lost all claim to ever use religious language again.
So, Terry, of course, as a Christian, my hackles are up on this a little bit, but I want to hear what you have to say. Do you think that the charge of hypocrisy by Mayor Pete is going to eventually stick, and will it taint the Republican Party because of his commentary?
No. And if you go back to the founding of our country, when we declared independence from Great Britain, we appealed to the laws of nature and nature's God and said that all men are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, including life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I don't think that Buttigieg really believes in those rights. I don't believe he believes in the natural law. In fact, he's married to another man. And I would argue, quite frankly, that a man marrying a man violates the natural law. You're mentioning St. Paul. I think St. Paul would make very clear, for example, in his letter to the Romans, which Mr. Buttigieg ought to read, that, yes, homosexual relations violate the natural law. And I think it presents a great problem for the Democrats, because they, when you get right down to it, they advocate policies like the deliberate killing of an innocent unborn child, like two men marrying each other, or like surrendering a child into a same-sex marriage where the child is either denied a mother or a father, that violate the natural law on which our founding fathers rested the rights of the people. And yes, those founding fathers were Christians, and their understanding of the natural law completely coincided with Christian understanding of morality. And if our nation moves away from that natural law that we recognize in our founding, like I think most of these Democrats would like us to do, we will lose our freedom, because that is the source and the root and the justification of our freedom.
And it's fairly facile to be able to write off an entire political party by saying you are hypocritical haters. And we've seen it before, and we've only seen it in increasing frequency now. So let's talk about Democratic governor from Colorado, John Hickenlooper, who predicted that an aggressive lurch to the left on key policies would ultimately hurt the Democrats' quest to defeat Trump. Let's listen.
Raise your hand if you're...
The bottom line is, if we don't clearly define that we are not socialists, the Republicans are going to come at us every way they can and call us socialists. And if you look at the Green New Deal, which I admire the sense of urgency and how important it is to do climate change, I'm a scientist, but we can't promise every American a government job. If you want to get universal health care coverage, I believe that health care is a right and not a privilege. But you can't expect to eliminate private insurance for 180 million people.
Well, I find it very interesting that he says if we don't clearly define we are not socialists, the Republicans will tar us with that. And yet, by my accounting, at least one of those individuals standing up would call themselves a Democratic socialist. And P.S., we happen to elect one from Brooklyn, New York, who is currently serving in the U.S. House of Representatives. So what is your take on that? Is he right about the fact that they are not socialists and have to clearly define such definition?
I don't think he's right about the fact they are socialists. I think that they are, in fact, advancing socialist policies. For example, they most of them were essentially embracing the idea of Medicare for all, whether you get there gradually or immediately. Medicare for all is socialized medicine. And they all raised their hands when they asked whether, quote-unquote, undocumented aliens would get insurance under their health insurance plan. So they're talking about socialism for foreign nationals who break the law but coming to the United States. I think that if you look at it just in terms of cold political analysis, this is the problem the Democrats are putting themselves in by lurching so far to the left in this early primary season. President Trump was elected because, as a Republican, he was able to win states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Iowa, which in recent history Republicans have not often won, particularly Pennsylvania and Michigan. And he also, of course, won Ohio, which is the classic swing state, and Florida, which is also a modern swing state. But why was it that President Trump was able to win Pennsylvania when, you know, more immediate Republican presidential candidates weren't, win Michigan? I would say in part is because he did present himself as a social conservative. If he wasn't pro-life, he wouldn't have won those states. But he ran as a pro-life candidate. Secondly, I think his views on foreign policy and trade and the way he talked about economics and talked about middle class and working Americans and making sure they had jobs and an upwardly mobile standard of living were important things. And I think for the Democrats, when first they present themselves as social liberals who are in favor of same-sex marriage and abortion on demand, and then present themselves, some of them, as having an interventionist foreign policy, as we saw the first night, they're actually putting themselves on the exact opposite side of the very swing vote they need to hold in 2020 to defeat Donald Trump. And so I think it's very ironic. And, I think if you go back and you look at Bill Clinton when he was running for president, and Bill Clinton used to say he wanted to make abortion safe, legal, and rare. He wasn't promoting same-sex marriage. He was trying to appeal, as a guy who's from Arkansas, to that vote in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Barack Obama, when he ran for president, he said he was against same-sex marriage. And he tried to play down his very radical views on abortion in the Illinois State Senate, which were he had very extremely radical views. But if you have the Democrats in this early primary season being pushed to the left by the candidates that are out there now participating in these debates, they have absolutely no chance of getting the nomination but can play themselves up on a national stage by advocating very radical points of view, I think it really does hurt their chances in the general election against Trump.
Well, and I think we've just talked about socialism. Bernie Sanders following up, talking about how he would protect abortion rights through Medicare for all, is evidence of the fact that they have gone so far to the left, they do not recognize the import of recent research indicating that the majority of Americans believe in at least some restriction on abortion. So this appears to be a field that is slightly out of touch with the pulse of America. Terry, thank you so much for joining me today on Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at FRC, filling in for Tony Perkins. Coming up next, two recent Supreme Court rulings on the census and on gerrymandering. Ken Blackwell, FRC's Senior Fellow for Human Rights and Constitutional Governance and co-chairman of the Census Monitoring Board, will join me next.
Can United States senators interrogate court nominees on their religious beliefs? This is a controversial question that our country is facing today. In light of this controversy, FRC has taken up the task of answering this question with one of their latest publications, Rebels Without a Clause. We've seen in recent Senate confirmation hearings a troubling pattern arise where senators have begun questioning presidential nominees about their faith as an attempt to discredit them. These interrogations have gone so far as to asking nominees of their theological beliefs, church membership, and associations with faith-based nonprofits. It has been an alarming display of hostility toward religion and people of faith. Visit frc.org/test to learn what questioning the Constitution's No Religious Test Clause allows and forbids in the process of confirming judicial nominees. That's frc.org/test.
The latest Trojan horse on Capitol Hill is called the Equality Act. The way the left is advertising this bill is misleading because it does not further equality at all. It would actually violate current protections in place that allow private institutions and people of faith to freely act in accordance to their deeply held beliefs. The Equality Act explicitly removes religious liberty protections that were originally put in place with bipartisan support. Its stated goal is equality, but its actual result is harm to vast members of communities, individuals, and Americans as a whole by undercutting our foundational freedom of religion. Is this really what equality looks like? A more fitting name for the Equality Act would be the Inequality Act. For more information on the mass threat of the Equality Act, visit frc.org/EqualityAct2019. That's frc.org/EqualityAct2019.
Many advances made by the homosexual movement are based on the claim that sexual orientation is immutable or unchangeable. This belief was a deciding factor in the 2015 Supreme Court case that redefined marriage to include same-sex couples. It has been a key argument for LGB activists fighting to restrict or ban therapies for people seeking help to overcome their same-sex attraction. But is sexual orientation written in stone? Should we brand people with an immovable sexual orientation label and tell them, you can't change, don't try to change, even if they want to? In a new publication from FRC, we reveal that sexual orientation can change. Survey data shows that heterosexuality is largely stable, but homosexuality is not. Even pro-LGB scholars are calling for the immutability argument to be abandoned. The question is, why is the LGB movement pushing this false argument? To learn more, visit frc.org/sexual orientation. That's frc.org/sexual orientation.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships. I am sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Friday edition. TonyPerkins.com is our podcast website. At T. Perkins, Tony's Twitter handle, mine, at Sarah P. Perry. Well, yesterday, the Supreme Court announced two rulings. They are coming fast and furious as the term comes to a close. In the first, a blow to the Trump administration on Thursday, the Supreme Court made what many believe is an incorrect decision on whether a question about the citizenship status can be included on the 2020 census. And ruled 5-4 to send it back to the lower courts for additional review. And in the second 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court decided that federal courts lack the authority to decide partisan gerrymanders, which is a fancy term for when elected politicians are too political, when they draw boundary lines to favor one party over another. I'll talk with Ken Blackwell, FRC Senior Fellow for Human Rights and Constitutional Governance and co-chairman of the Census Monitoring Board now. Ken, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Sarah, good to be with you.
So let's talk first about the census case. Now, this both opinions were written by Chief Justice John Roberts, but it is notable to say that the Supreme Court really didn't address the main issue. It didn't come to the question of whether or not a census question on citizenship was a violation of the law, but instead said essentially, we didn't receive enough information from the Commerce Department. Leaves the door open for the citizen question to be included on the census in the future. Were you surprised by the outcome in this case?
Yes, I was particularly surprised because in the other case that we will talk about, the court showed great judicial restraint. And by that I meant that they said that activism of the bench could not, in fact, override the responsibility of state legislatures. Well, Now they basically are saying that through judicial activism, they're going to override the Secretary of Commerce, who has the right to reestablish a question that was raised regularly on the census. And what they're saying is that there's no question that he has that right, but he does not have unbound authority in making a decision to reinstate it. He has to do it on the basis of data and fact. And they said there was sufficient reason or doubt that he had done his homework to make that decision. Therefore, they in fact remanded case back to district courts. This is pretty clear. That's a legitimate question to ask on a document, in this case, the census, to determine the citizenship and the eligibility of folks to receive the benefits of federal resources. You would have to have the imagination of Walt Disney to reach any other conclusion than that's a legitimate question on a census document that will determine how resources are dispersed.
And it's interesting because Justice Roberts, in both decisions issued, the actual order himself wrote the majority opinion, but he almost seems to take two different perspectives on two slightly related issues. In other words, whether or not this is a justiciable issue and whether or not the question is in and of itself constitutional. So let's switch over to the gerrymandering case. In that case, they did rule that partisan gerrymandering is not appropriate. It's a non-justiciable issue, not appropriate for determination by the court. And federal courts really should lack the authority to decide partisan gerrymanders. That should be left up to the legislature. So what do you think about this decision?
It was the correct decision. We have separation of powers for a reason. And drawing district lines through the apportionment process is a legislative process. And the fact of the matter is that political gerrymandering is, in fact, legal. Where the courts have, in fact, got involved is when gerrymandering was done to disadvantage a racial or ethnic group. And so what the court basically said here is that you can't take politics out of politics, and the judiciary does not have the tools nor the perspective to tell the legislative branch how to draw their lines or how to do their business, particularly when it is not related to a discriminatory act that disadvantages a racial or ethnic group.
Well, in writing for the dissent, it was sort of an energetic response by Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor, who would have been the ones I think you and I would have anticipated could have written the dissent from the outset. And Elena Kagan wrote, for the first time ever, this court refuses to remedy a constitutional violation because it thinks the task beyond judicial capabilities. But that's not really an accurate assessment of what happened.
Absolutely. That opinion, dissenting opinion, was written by two of the court's leading judicial activists. And basically, they've never saw an issue that they didn't think that they knew better than the people, you know, better than the administration, or better than the legislative branch that represents the people of the United States across the country. And so they are quite gifted at meddling in the sphere where they have no business being involved. And so in this case, Roberts wrote the opinion for the conservative side, the jurists and the justices that stand for restraint and a respect of the separation of powers.
Ken Blackwell has been my guest. Ken, I have to cut you off.
Okay.
We have to talk more next time. This is Washington Watch, but coming up next, we have former Turkish missionary and pastor Andrew Brunson, his testimony yesterday before USERF, and one of the commissioners to talk about the hearing next.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
There is unprecedented religious persecution around the globe. In recent years, research has found increasing governmental and social hostility towards religious believers worldwide. For the last 10 years, Christians have been harassed in more countries, including the United States, than any other religious group. While the specific threats to religious freedom vary in type and intensity, one common source is the legal and cultural support for apostasy, blasphemy, and anti-conversion laws, which often threaten the freedom to choose or change one's faith. In a new publication from Family Research Council, we list which nations around the world have these unjust laws on the books and spotlight people who have faced severe penalties simply for sharing or changing their faith. For more information on religious hostility due to apostasy, blasphemy, and anti-conversion laws around the world, visit frc.org/ABA laws. That's frc.org/ABA laws.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here, filling in for Tony Perkins on this Friday edition. Well, yesterday, evangelical missionary Andrew Brunson said that the authoritarian crackdown and struggling economy in Turkey are actually causing more Turks to show interest in the Bible at a time in which storm clouds of Christian persecution seem to be forming. Brunson, as you'll remember, is a North Carolina native who spent 2 decades planting churches in Turkey before spending 2 years in prison on trumped-up terrorism charges. He expressed a deep concern about the future of Turkey's small Protestant population during a hearing hosted by the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom on Capitol Hill, of which our Tony Perkins is president. Brunson was released from prison last October after months of pressure from the U.S. government. And joining me now is Christina Arriaga, who is a commissioner of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom and was there during yesterday's hearings. Christina, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Pastor Brunson testified that there is still a high degree of freedom for Christians relative to other Muslim countries in the region, but I am concerned that all signs point to this changing soon, end quote. Christina, do you feel the same way?
Oh, absolutely. The first time I met Andrew Brunson was in prison. He was behind bars in Turkey. He had already spent 12 months in prison without even being charged. He was in a cell meant for eight people. There were terrible conditions that he was under, and the legal system in Turkey was not working for him. In fact, it doesn't work. He was charged 18 months later, and the government leaked the indictment to the press before it was even presented to Andrew Brunson. Commissioner Perkins went to one of his trials, so did I. Unfortunately, rule of law in Turkey, when it comes to religious freedom and many other issues, does not work. And this is particularly impacting Christians in Turkey.
We have a clip from Pastor Brunson's testimony in which he actually said that in Turkey, Christianity is considered a danger to Turkey's unity. Let's listen.
My indictment and trial give an example of how the Turkish government views Christians. When my indictment came out, it became clear that I had been targeted specifically because of my faith. My crime was Christianization, acting as, I quote, an agent of unconventional and psychological warfare under the guise of an evangelical church pastor. All of our work was intended to fragment Turkey, they said, splitting it into pieces. So basically, the indictment was associating Christianization with terrorism and presented Christianity as a danger to Turkey's unity.
So here's my question to you, Christina. Where do we see the genesis of this growing hostility to Christianity and Christian missionaries like Mr. Brunson on the part of the Erdogan government? Where is this coming from?
It is coming from a place of fear of anyone who does not agree with Erdogan. Erdogan has increasingly become a despot, a dictator. He's threatened. I mean, there are only about 6,000 Christians in Turkey. And regrettably, just in the last 3 months, over 50% of churches there have lost their pastors, the head of their churches, because they have been deported out of the country, and that continues to increase. Whenever there's a group of people that understand their rights do not come from the state, they come from something above the state, they become instantly a threat. Also, Erdogan himself has said to be Turk is to be Muslim, and not only Muslim, but a Sunni Muslim, a devout Muslim, and that it becomes a terrible danger for Christians because all of the media is controlled by the government. Television shows are controlled by the government. And there could be a great incitement of hatred, mistakenly thinking that Christians are somehow anti-Turk. Andrew Brunson made it very clear at the beginning and at the ending of his testimony that he loves the Turkish people, that he loves Turkey, that all he wanted to talk was about the message of the Bible. That was it. Instead, he was portrayed as a spy, as a dangerous man, as a terrorist, and as you mentioned earlier, spent 2 years in prison and was convicted of being a terrorist. He was allowed to leave the country after Erdogan was under a lot of pressure from the United States government.
And in fact, Turkey attempted to sort of connect the dots between evangelical Christianity, evangelism, and church planting, and actual terrorism by really kind of stretching and saying that as someone who promoted Christianity, that there was sort of an inherent danger to Turkey. And there wasn't truly much evidence at all that there was anything but love that he was communicating, was there?
There was zero evidence presented at the trial that Andrew Brunson was nothing but a man who wanted to bring the word of God to the people of Turkey. The 63-page indictment was filled with secret evidence from secret witnesses. At the trial, I myself heard the judges not ask for evidence. No evidence was presented, and there was no evidence asked for. This was all a sham to blame Andrew Brunson for set up some sort of distraction from the issue that, because of Erdogan, Turkey's suffering, like an issue with economy, an issue with aligning itself with Russia and Iran. And Erdogan has created this whole narrative around this innocent man just to create a scapegoat for his own regime.
Christina Arriaga has been my guest today on this Friday edition of Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Well, coming up next, you may not know, but June 29th is the day of the Christian martyr, following church tradition teaching that the day marks the martyrdom of Apostle Paul. I'll talk with Todd Nettleton, the president of Voice of the Martyrs, coming up next.
Did you know that babies survive failed abortions? Sadly, many of these babies are denied their human right to life and are allowed to die. Currently, there's no federal criminal statute in place to protect these babies after they're born alive. Congress and state legislatures across the country have responded by putting forth legislation to protect infants who survive abortion. However, leftist politicians have blocked efforts in Congress and in state legislatures to pass the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, which requires that life-saving medical care be given to babies born alive after failed abortion attempts. We must decide as a country where we stand on the issue of infanticide, to either pursue humane protections for those most vulnerable in our society, or continue to subject innocent human life to the whims of abortionists. For more information, visit frc.org/bornalive. Today, military personnel are at greater risk than ever of suffering from a mental health condition. On average, 21 active and retired military members take their own lives every day. Richard Gleaston, a military and veteran advocate in the area of mental health, recently shared evidence that faith-based solutions can help stop this crisis. Here's what Richard had to say.
There's new science out that they watch people while they're praying or have a religious relationship. The frontal part of their brain, if I'm correct in remembering what they told me, it strengthens it. It reduces depression, reduces anxiety and stress while you're doing it. So not only did God give us prayer as a way to alleviate our spirit, it also alleviates our mind and our bodies. Our bodies react in a positive way to a faith-based relationship.
Visit frc.org/speakers to hear more.
Did you know that thanks to President Trump, abortion giant Planned Parenthood can no longer receive up to $60 million in federal funding? This new federal protection for the unborn is thanks to a rule change that the Trump administration implemented to the Title X Family Planning Grant Program, which will take effect in May 2019. Not only do the new Title X rule changes take funding away from our nation's largest abortion supplier, they also ensure that taxpayer dollars are not used for abortion and open the door for pro-life pregnancy resource centers and other faith-based organizations to apply for Title X funds, thus expanding the health care options of needy families who are experiencing unexpected pregnancies. For more information about the new Title X rule changes that protect the unborn and increase health care options, visit frc.org/Title X. That's frc.org/Title X.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. It is Friday. I am your Friday host, Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins today. TonyPerkins.com is our podcast address, at T Perkins. Follow Tony on Twitter, or me if you'd like, at Sarah P. Perry. Heading into this holiday weekend, we're wishing everyone an early happy 4th of July. Well, June 29th is the day of the Christian martyr. Church tradition teaches that it is the day that marks the martyrdom of the Apostle Paul. You can learn more and download free digital resources at persecution.com/martyr. As he pioneered evangelistic practices and planted several dozen churches, Paul did exactly what we talked about Pastor Brunson doing. He went out, he preached the good word, but he also wrote this passage in 2 Corinthians 11:25 to 28, which says this: "Three times I was beaten with rods, once I was pelted with stones, three times I was shipwrecked, I spent a night and a day in the open sea, I have been constantly on the move. I have been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from my fellow Jews, in danger from Gentiles, in danger in the city, in danger in the country, in danger at sea, and in danger from false believers. I have labored and toiled and gone without sleep. I have known hunger and thirst and have gone without food. I have been cold and naked." And yet, this amazing testimony propels so much of what we understand it is to be grateful in the heart of difficult things because of who we know we are doing it for. What an amazing testimony. Perhaps most poignantly, Paul wrote in Philippians 3:10, "I want to know Christ, yes, to know the power of his resurrection and participate in his sufferings, becoming like him in his death, and so somehow attaining to the resurrection from the dead. Joining me now to talk about the Day of the Christian Martyr is Todd Nettleton, host of The Voice of the Martyrs. Todd, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
Well, Todd, I had the great pleasure of taking a trip that was based on Paul's missionary journeys. And I have seen the prison cell in which it is believed that Paul was held. But I'd like to talk a little bit about his martyrdom for our listeners who are not specifically familiar with the ending to his life. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, as we know, Paul was sent to Rome to stand trial before Caesar. Church history teaches that he was eventually beheaded just outside the walls of the city of Rome. And the date of that, according to church history, June 29th. That's why we're celebrating the Day of the Christian Martyrs this year, commemorating not just Paul, but all of those who have given their lives for Christ throughout history. And as we know, that's still happening today. Those people are still giving their lives today. And so we want to kind of hold them up and honor their sacrifice. But we also want to challenge American Christians to say, hey, what would you sacrifice? What would you lay down to see Christ's name glorified in a place like Afghanistan, in a place where it is not known now? That's what we hope comes out of this first Day of the Christian Martyr.
Well, for those who don't know what some of the subsequent martyrs were, some of the additional individuals who did give their lives in the pursuit of the gospel and in maintenance of their adherence to that perfect truth. Let's talk also about Stephen, who was likewise a Christian martyr. You know, some of us think immediately of Paul, but we forget Stephen in Acts 7. Can you talk a little bit about his martyrdom?
Well, Stephen was stoned. He stood strong for Christ, and I love the story of him before the council. His face lit up by the Holy Spirit power that was on him. He was stoned to death, and the man who held the coats of those who were stoning him was Saul, who would then go on to become Paul and die for his faith in Christ himself. And you know, that really ties into what we're trying to do with the Day of the Christian Martyr, is hold up these examples so that we can watch, we can look on and see what is happening and follow their example. Just as Saul followed the example of Stephen when it came time to face death, I wonder if he thought back and say, hey, I remember how Stephen faced death. I remember how Stephen said, don't hold this against them, Lord. They don't even know what they're doing. I suspect that some of those thoughts were going through Paul's mind. That's why we look at the lives of those who gave their life for Christ, for that sense of inspiration to carry with us into our own lives.
You know, I can't read anything that Paul has written without being eternally and immediately convicted about the fact that I complain if, for example, it's too hot in the bedroom and I am not able to sleep at night. You know, he really does put into perspective what it is to live for Christ and die as gain. And every time I think about that passage in Corinthians, I am immediately reminded of how difficult his earthly time was, but how he understood so fully that what he was sacrificing, what he was enduring was so very worth the cost that he employed. And I think that is so the nature of these giants of the faith, those individuals who held fast to what they knew was the truth, even in the face of great difficulty. So let's change timelines here a little bit. I also want to change geographies and talk a little bit about the Nagasaki martyrs of 1597, which I have to tell you, before I did some research, was not a story I had ever heard of before. Can you tell our listeners about that?
Well, you know, I can't off the top of my head. I know that story is told in our book, Fox, Voices of the Martyrs, but it has been a while since I read it, and I would have to do some research as well.
Well, so what I have looked into is that these were Jesuit missionaries. They arrived in Japan around 1549, planting the seeds of what soon became a small church. And isn't this surprising how so many of these stories start the same way? These are individuals who are going out to evangelize and plant churches so that that truth can produce more fruit and can produce more fruit and subsequently more truth. And it is really fascinating to me that this all starts the same way. These are people going out to preach. These are people going out to church plant. And such was the situation with the Jesuit missionaries. And the government grew suspicious of foreign influence. This sounds like a page immediately out of today's headlines on international religious liberty. All the priests were ordered to leave the country, and 26 men, including 7 foreigners, were frequently arrested. There was a month-long winter march. A month. So I want our listeners to think about that. This is 1 month on which they were driven through the winter weather continuously without end. The men were then crucified on Nishizaka Hill, praying and singing before being hung on crosses. And of course, over the next 2 centuries, Christians in Japan continued to meet secretly before finally making contact with French priests who were allowed into Japan in the 1850s, and subsequently, the whole nature of religious liberty in the country of Japan has changed for the better, has become more free because of these individuals willing to sacrifice their lives. So you also talk about some modern martyrs in South Africa. And this was a name, and this name is also on the website as well. If you go to persecution.org/martyrs, so I encourage you to visit this.
.com.
Thank you. persecution.com/martyrs. I want to talk a little bit about the story of modern martyrs in South Africa. Missionaries Jean-Pierre Werner and Rode Guldenwald, on November 29th, 2014, in Afghanistan. So here we have pushed forward the chronology of human events, and here we are now, really just a few years ago. Talk to me a little bit about their story.
Well, they have an amazing story of sacrifice, an amazing story of faithfulness. Their names actually will be unveiling tomorrow in a Facebook Live event as part of the Day of the Christian Martyr. After 9/11, God called the Groenwald family from South Africa to go to Afghanistan. Now, they had a very comfortable life in South Africa. Werner was on staff at a church. His wife, Hannah Lee, was an emergency room doctor. They had a good life. And you think about the time period after 9/11, who would want to go to Afghanistan? And in fact, I interviewed Hannah Lee, and she said, you know, some people in our own family said, there is no way that that's the voice of God, because God would never ask you to take your children to a war zone like Afghanistan. But they said, no, it is God. He's calling us to go there. And they went. They went knowing there was the possibility of persecution, knowing there was the possibility of suffering, knowing it would be a very difficult work. And they went. They served the Afghan people for more than 10 years. Hannah Lee, as a female doctor, had just amazing ministry opportunities in that culture and in that country to treat female Afghans and to minister to them. But in 2014, there was an attack on their home, and there had been some sort of intelligence that there was going to be an attack, and there was a UN meeting going on in Kabul that day. And so the UN authorities asked Hannah Lee, as a doctor, will you come to the site of this UN meeting, because we've heard there might be an attack. We want to have a doctor on site to treat the wounded. Well, the attack happened, but it happened at their home. And her husband, Werner, was killed. Her teenagers, Jean-Pierre and Rode, were killed as well, giving their lives for the sake of the gospel in Afghanistan. And that's why we're honoring them, because of that spirit of sacrifice. And Hannah Lee has an amazing testimony. She lost her whole family in one day. I don't think any of us can imagine anything that could happen to us that would be worse than that. But God sustained her through that, and not only sustained her, but gave her the ability to love the Afghan people, to forgive even the Taliban, even the people that took her husband's and her children's lives. She was able to forgive them with God's power. And so this is the kind of examples that we're holding up on the Day of the Christian Martyr. Let's admire their service. Let's admire their spirit. And let's ask ourselves, Lord, give me that kind of courage. Give me that kind of ability to say, no, serving Jesus is more important than my comfort. It's even more important than my own life.
I have to tell you, I am always sort of reignited in my own faith when I hear about the stories of people who have suffered such tremendous affliction for the nature of their faith and for their adherence to their faith. And for me, particularly as a wife and mother, I think about how Hannah Lee must have felt, understanding that it was one thing, and her refusal to give up Jesus, that one thing was what resulted and the ultimate loss of her entire family. I'm immediately reminded of the verse in Revelation, and that's Revelation 2:10, which has been a key verse, and I'm sure you know it well, for the church grappling with the martyrdom of loved ones, which says, "Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life," which, Todd, I have to tell you, I have to say, in my heart of hearts, if I am Hannah Lee, this is what I cling to. This has to be that verse from which she gleans comfort.
I think you're so right. The other verse that I think of often is in Revelation 6, where it talks about the spirit of the martyr saying, "How long, Lord? How long are you going to let this go on? How long are you going to put up with your servants being slaughtered?" And the Lord says, "Wait just a little while longer until the number is complete. I know how many there are going to be, and when that number is complete, then your suffering is over." So the Lord certainly knew about Werner and Jean-Pierre and Rodé Groenewald. He knew what would happen that day, and he strengthened them. In fact, a month before the attack, it's interesting to think about, Werner was delivering a sermon, and as he wrapped up his sermon, he said, "You know, we're only going to die once. We might as well die for Jesus Christ." And a month later, he laid down his life for Christ in Afghanistan.
What an incredible testimony that goes on to bless other people like you and me, like the listeners to this program, who realize exactly how strong the human spirit is when it is emboldened with the good news of the gospel. How exciting, particularly in this day and age when international religious liberty is at the forefront of all of our minds and President Trump is entering into his summit with China's president. And we know that the Chinese authorities raided the Morningstar Church in China's southern Guangxi province at 10 a.m. Beijing time yesterday. This is as recently as 24 hours ago, and detained a number of Christians, among which were the church's leaders and the most prominent attendees. Do you know whether any of these have been released as of today?
I have not heard that they have been released, and there's still the pastor of Early Rain Covenant Church who was arrested last December. We don't even know where he's being held. Mm-hmm. And so I hope that as President Trump sits down with the Chinese leadership, that our Christian brothers and sisters will be a part of that conversation. I hope that is high on his list of things to talk about with President Xi.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. For more information about the Day of the Christian Martyr, which is tomorrow, June 29th, and to download free digital resources, we encourage you all to go to persecution.com. That's persecution.com/martyr. This has been Washington Watch. I have been your Friday host, Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here, sitting in for Tony Perkins. As always, go to TonyPerkins.com for our podcast. For more information and resources, follow Tony on Twitter at TPerkins. Follow me, if you'd like, at Sarah P. Perry. We'll talk to you next time on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported.
for more information on anything you've heard today or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.